Russian protesters detained by the hundreds this weekend in Moscow, including Daniel Sotnikov, who live-streamed the entire event.
I didn't even notice the police van ride.
Journalist!
I was trying to say them that I'm a journalist.
Police may have cleared the streets of Moscow fast, but the demonstrators vowed to return in even bigger numbers. And China's social credit system, it's not what a lot of people first thought.
The main misconception is that it's a rating system for all citizens, that there's some sort of a number that's going up and down like in the nosedive episode of Black Mirror.
Plus, pure joy in Colombia after a native son wins the Tour de France. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and much more today here on The World. Large protests in Moscow over the weekend got ugly. Police arrested more than 1,300 people. That is unprecedented in recent Russian history. The demonstrations were about the Moscow City Council elections coming up in September and the fact that the Moscow Election Commission barred opposition candidates from running. Alexei Navalny is probably the most well-known opposition leader in Russia. He was not among those arrested on Saturday. That's because Navalny was already in prison. He was detained last week. And yesterday, Navalny was reportedly taken from jail to a hospital with some kind of severe allergic reaction. That's led to speculation and fears that he was poisoned. So what is going on here? Daniel Sotnikov was covering all of this for TV Rain, independent television channel in Russia. He joins us now from Moscow. Describe, Daniel, what it's been like for protesters in the streets of Moscow over the past couple of days.
So it was not my first protest, but this one, the police tried to intimidate. They started detaining random people on the street. The police goal was to keep the street empty, but they didn't succeed. The crowd began to grow. And the police were trying to divide the crowd. There were no internet connection, no cell phone connection. And at this point, nobody knew what's going on. That's when the police started to detain people and to act more aggressively. I've never seen something like that before. The huge crowd was walking on the street of Moscow, yelling some slogans, and nobody was controlling them.
Daniel, what was the crowd actually yelling?
So there were many slogans. They mostly yelled something about Putin, that Putin is a thief and should go away. The main slogan was to let them be elected. It's about the candidates for Moscow elections. At some point, the crowd also started to sing national anthem. And that's also the first time I heard something like that. The crowd had the Russian flags and Russian anthem as the symbols of this protest, and that's completely new. And I think that maybe people are understood that they're together, they're united, and that's why they choose to sing Russian anthem and to go with the flags.
Daniel, let's switch gears to Alexei Navalny and what he's been going through. He was in prison and then yesterday was hospitalized. I know you were covering the story. You were actually outside the hospital where he was hospitalized. What were you able to learn?
So, yeah, yesterday I read about his hospitalization. And at first, it was just a suspicion that it might be more to that story than just allergic reaction. But after his doctor wrote that it might be poisoning, so I understood that people will probably go to his hospital, and I live nearby, so I decided to go there as a journalist, and I started a stream to tell our viewers what's going on near
right,
the hospital,
you started commenting.
And I didn't even notice the police van arrived. And in a few seconds, I was detained. They put me in the police van. I was trying to say them that I'm a journalist. And in a few seconds, they cleared the street entirely. Everybody was detained.
It's pretty stunning because you continue your commentary as you're being detained. And as you said, you're crying out, journalist, I'm a journalist. And even in the dark of the police van, you keep on reporting. I got to say, you're pretty brave.
Actually, that's a normal thing for us because I think all of our correspondents was detained at some point of their career. And it's really good action in the stream. So you have to understand that the people are still watching you. And when you got in the van, it's even more important to continue streaming because the people are detained with you and they don't have the same rights as you as a journalist. But after half an hour, the police, they asked who is the representative of the media here. I answered and they put me on the street, back on the street, and I continued my work. And all these people who were detained with me, they was brought to police station and released only in the morning.
Yeah. Daniel, there's another protest slated for next weekend. What are you expecting to see next weekend? And do you think any attempts to stop next weekend's protests could be more aggressive over the coming days?
I think it's just too early to say, because if authorities will say, yes, you can go here and there on this place, square or that street, that will be one type of protest. And if authorities will again choose the more aggressive way and will say, no, you may not go on the street, that will be completely different. And another factor is that all the leaders of the protest are now in jail and will be in jail this Saturday. So it will be the protest without leaders on the street.
Daniel Sotnikov is a journalist with TV Rain, speaking with us about the protests in Moscow and attempts by authorities to stop his reporting. Daniel, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Another high-level departure from the Trump administration is coming. It's not entirely a surprise, but it is a big one.
Got some breaking news here. President Trump just tweeting that he will be replacing the current Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats. In his tweet just moments ago, the president wrote, quote, "I am pleased to announce that highly respected Congressman John Ratcliffe of Texas will be nominated by me to be the Director of National Intelligence."
Coats had a tense relationship with the president over some high-profile security threats, including Russia, Iran, and North Korea.
Well, the president says that he's going to nominate Texas Republican Congressman John Ratcliffe to replace Dan Coats as the Director of National Intelligence.
Ratcliffe aggressively questioned former special counsel Robert Mueller last week in defense of the president.
I agree with the chairman this morning when he said Donald Trump is not above the law. He's not. But he damn sure shouldn't be below the law, which is where volume two of this report puts him.
The Director of National Intelligence is America's top intelligence official. The DNI oversees the CIA and 16 other U.S. spy agencies. The position was created in the aftermath of September 11th, 2001.
There was no silver bullet that could have prevented the 9/11 attacks.
That's former National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice speaking in 2004.
In hindsight, if anything might have helped stop 9/11, it would have been better information about threats inside the United States, something made very difficult by structural and legal impediments that prevented the collection and sharing of information by our law enforcement and intelligence agencies.
A couple of months later, President George W. Bush signed the Intelligence Reform and Prevention Act into law, creating the new position of Director of National Intelligence.
The DNI will have the authority to order the collection of new intelligence, to ensure the sharing of information among agencies, and to establish common standards for the intelligence community's personnel.
The DNI controls budgets, briefs the president daily on national security threats. But maybe most importantly, the DNI is supposed to prevent the kind of bureaucratic snafus that kept U.S. intelligence agencies from stopping the attacks on September 11th. Fair to say, it is a serious job. Yesterday, Senator Mark Warner, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, tweeted that the mission of the DNI is to speak truth to power. By most accounts, Dan Coats stayed true to that mission. But what about Donald Trump's pick for the job, Republican Congressman John Ratcliffe? The Senate will have to confirm Ratcliffe as DNI. Democrats and reportedly some Republicans are wondering if he's too political for the position. Carrie Cordero was a senior attorney in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the ODNI. She's now a fellow at the Center for a New American Security in Washington. I asked her first about Ratcliffe's experience.
Well, he has a different background than the prior individuals who have served as Director of National Intelligence. All of the prior DNIs have either been intelligence professionals themselves over decades of experience or have had long government careers in the executive branch where they have been consumers of intelligence information. John Ratcliffe doesn't have that deep of a background as those other individuals. He has spent some time as a congressional overseer, and he's been a U.S. attorney in the Justice Department.
That counts for something, though, right?
It does count for something. He's a member of Congress. He served on the Intelligence Committee. I don't think he had a long tenure there. As for his U.S. attorney record, I would expect during his confirmation process that his record as U.S. attorney will be scrutinized. He was the U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Texas. I can't immediately think of any major national security case that I'm aware of that was handled in that district while he was the U.S. attorney, but I'm sure that record will be scrutinized during the confirmation process.
What would all this mean if he's confirmed in terms of the safety of the average person out there from things like foreign and domestic terrorism?
Well, remember, the Director of National Intelligence does not lead an operational national security agency. So he sits up high and is implementing policy to make sure that the intelligence community is working properly. But he is responsible for the briefing that goes to senior policymakers and to the president. And so the concern is that high-level intelligence assessments, for example, threats about future foreign hostile state efforts to interfere in our elections, which is a big picture issue, he would be responsible for making sure that the best intelligence assessment gets to the president. And given, for example, his performance in the hearing of Special Counsel Mueller last week, where he really came across as quite partisan, the concerns that I think will be aired in his confirmation hearing pertain to whether or not he really is willing and capable of being an impartial communicator of a considered intelligence assessment, or whether he will be malleable to the president's interests in determining what intelligence information is.
I mean, Donald Trump either denies or doesn't want to believe that the Russians were involved in the last election and hacking. He even said Putin told him they didn't do it and he believed him. Does Donald Trump want an intelligence yes man next to him who will allow foreign entities meddle in the next election?
Well, it certainly looks from his administration that he has gotten rid of, either through firing or forced resignations, cabinet leaders or senior advisors who have been willing to challenge him on these types of issues, including national security issues. So we don't know whether or not he was considering removing Director of National Intelligence Coates before or after he formed that task force focused on 2020 election security. But it certainly is a question that needs to be raised during the confirmation hearing. And so far, the president has been consistent in his lack of presidential leadership to develop a whole of government strategy to counter election interference efforts.
The New York Times is reporting that Senator Richard Burr warned the White House that John Ratcliffe was too political for the job of DNI. How certain is Ratcliffe's confirmation at this point?
Well, I think Chairman Burr, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, issued a statement today saying that once Congressman Ratcliffe has been formally nominated, the committee will engage in its process according to regular order. So certainly they'll take up the nomination. I did not read his statement to be a rousing endorsement, but we'll see how that process plays out.
Carrie Cordero, fellow at the Center for a New American Security in Washington, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much.
At theworld.org and on the radio, you're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Protests in Hong Kong are not letting up. Over the weekend, police and demonstrators clashed in the streets again. What's not clear is how it will all end. And that's got some Hong Kong business leaders worried. The American Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong is the biggest international business association in the territory. It's now calling on the Hong Kong government to address protesters' demands. Tyra Joseph is president of the chamber.
Well, I've lived in Hong Kong for almost 17 years. So I've been through the umbrella movement. I've been through lots of changes. These protests feel different because it's hard to know where the leadership is. They've been going on for 8 weeks without any end in sight. And there is a feeling of pessimism and a sense of not knowing when this is going to end. And that hurts the business sentiment.
So what exactly is the American Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong asking both the Hong Kong and Beijing governing powers to do here?
What we'd really like to see are two things. One is a sense of adherence to one country, two systems, and that very important framework for business. The other thing is that the Hong Kong government come out with a strong communication about how they intend to move forward to restore business confidence. It's been very quiet over the last few weeks. Understandably, there's been some wrestling with how to deal with this, but in order not to lose the faith and comfort of the international business community that really helps this city tick, it's important to be out there and restoring business confidence.
What have you heard from members of the American Chamber of Commerce? Like, where have they lost confidence? What specific incidents?
Well, it's a feeling that it's hard to know whether there'll be further encroachments from Beijing, for example, or whether there's a real way to help these protests end and to soothe the fears of the protesters. Also, whether the government can move forward with so many important initiatives to move Hong Kong up the value chain, both in the digital economy and in building links with the Greater Bay Area or Shenzhen and other parts of southern China. All of those efforts that the Hong Kong government has talked about but have now been stalled because everything's focused on these protests.
So with the American Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong essentially calling on the governments to address protesters' demands, I mean, if it's not a precise political position, it does sound like the chamber is inserting itself into politics. Is this unprecedented, and were you considering what reaction would be?
It is a very difficult time because for business chambers, our real hope is to focus on business. But we have reached a point where politics are blurring into business sentiment. It is unusual for us as a business chamber to speak out about politics. It's happened a few times over the course of our 50-year history, but it is rare. But we have reached an important inflection point for Hong Kong. And for Hong Kong to continue being a strong premier international business center in Asia, it's important for us to speak out.
So how far is the American Chamber of Commerce willing to go in making some kind of political push here?
Well, that's a difficult question. We have a constant and regular dialogue with the Hong Kong government. We went very far in terms of the extradition bill. We were very outspoken about feeling the need for that to be withdrawn, at least shelved. And that was something that we felt very, very strongly about.
I mean, it does seem like that extradition bill has been shelved. Would more confidence arrive for businesses in Hong Kong if it were officially terminated?
I think more confidence would be built because the protesters feel very strongly about the bill being withdrawn to alleviate the fears of it coming back. Mm. If Hong Kong doesn't maintain that real confidence in one country, two systems, then people really could start to enact backup plans. There are other cities in Asia that are becoming increasingly competitive.
Beijing, as you know, has army units in Hong Kong. At what point do you worry that they could be mobilized?
It seems unlikely, and that really would be the worst case scenario. I think it was generally comforting today to hear from Beijing authorities that they were pushing the ball back into Hong Kong's court to deal with it. It would be a very, very difficult state of affairs if the PLA were to leave their garrisons, and I think people would see that as something like a last approach.
Tara Joseph, president of the American Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong, speaking with us from Hong Kong. Thanks very much, Tara.
Thank you.
Megadeth, Pantera, Slayer. You don't have to be a headbanger to know I'm talking about heavy metal. Now, I don't want to go peddling stereotypes here, but one thing I've never associated with metal is knitting. That is until I learned about the first ever heavy metal knitting world championship. It is real. And my BBC colleague Claire McDonald is here to prove it.
Heavy metal knitting. Any idea? Well, it's a team event. The knitter or knitters knit on stage in front of and in time with a heavy metal band. Not convinced? Well, let's hear from a woman who is.
My name is Nathalie Cortada, and I was the first ever person in the world to be on stage knitting to heavy metal. Heavy metal knitting is basically what it says on the tin, a mixture of heavy metal and knitting. Someone had the brilliant idea to combine the both and create this first heavy metal knitting world championship.
And that championship has just taken place in the town of Joensuu in Finland, with 12 finalists from Denmark, Finland, Japan, Latvia, Russia, Sweden, the US and the UK. You can wear anything, fancy dress preferred. You can perform anyhow you like. And as Nathalie explains, you can knit with anything.
I knit with unusual materials to take it to a new dimension. Pretty much 90% use recycled materials. Inner tube yarn is actually quite thick. You can't make it too thin because it might break or stretch. But it makes it really quite tough to knit. It's also quite smelly.
Giga Body Metal from Japan took home the top prize. Less knitting, more sumo wrestling, it has to be said. But the jury rate the performances by attitude, performance skills, audience reaction and by their heavy knitting hood. Denmark's Crafts came in second, with Needles from the US placing third. And if you're still not convinced about this marriage between haberdashery and headbanging, well, the organised say metal music is all about the rhythm, and so is knitting. And Nathalie agrees.
A lot of people have told me, you know, what the hell are you doing? What? Knitting? Heavy metal? How does that link up? And in knitting or crochet or any kind of textile work, there's a kind of rhythm to it, which goes very well with metal. Just let go, let loose, just go for it, knit.
The BBC's Claire McDonald reporting. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. China's social credit system might seem like a dystopian nightmare, simply a way for the Chinese government to track all its citizens.
One of the things that people get interested in social credit for is that they believe that it's a holistic integration of all of our digital footprint, and it's not that.
So what is it then exactly? That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. A few years ago, the Chinese government announced an ambitious new program to assess the trustworthiness of its citizens. You might have heard about China's so-called social credit system already.
If you thought the way Facebook tracks you was scary, it's got nothing on the Chinese government, which just unveiled a system of monitoring and grading every citizen's behavior.
Everything you do, everything you say,
what you buy, how you behave, is tracked.
China wants to grade its 1.3 billion people based on how good or bad of a citizen they've been.
It sounds like that show Black Mirror, but
it's not science fiction. In China, it's a reality.
A lot of that, Marco, it turns out, isn't true.
That's The World's Lydia Matalita, who's in the studio with me.
So I've been looking at this system with reporter Louise Matsakis over at Wired magazine, and she's on the line from New York.
So in the next few minutes, Lydia and I are going to explain why a lot of what you just heard about China's social credit system isn't true. But there are a lot of reasons that you should still be paying close attention to it anyway.
And first, we want to tell you about how this all started. And to find out, we reached out to Jay Stanley, who wrote one of the first pieces in English about the social credit system. He's a senior policy analyst for the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union.
I'm paid to be paranoid. I'm paid to worry about the dark side of technology and how it can serve authoritarian impulses in government and in corporations.
So it's 2015. And Stanley starts seeing social media posts and reports
about this, you know, really nightmarish sounding system.
China's social credit system.
So he's reading that by 2020, everyone in China will have this social credit score, which supposedly signals how obedient you are as a citizen. And it dictates your rights and freedoms. So if you do things that the Chinese government thinks are responsible, like buying diapers for your kid, your score might go up. If you do things that are irresponsible in the eyes of the government, like playing too many video games, your score will go down. A high score means you could get, say, an expedited travel visa, whereas a low score means you can't ride public transportation, or maybe you or your kids won't be able to go to a private school.
You know, I possess zero expertise on China, but I thought this was worth injecting into discussion because it seemed like such a crystal clear distillation of a lot of the dystopian fears that we Americans have about the system that we could be drifting towards.
Stanley was really outraged about what he was reading, so he quickly wrote a blog post on the ACLU's website, which was titled, China's Nightmarish Citizen Scores Are a Warning for Americans.
The piece got a lot of attention. It got a lot of hits in terms of people reading it on the ACLU site. There was a flurry of discussion and reaction to it at the time. It was picked up. It created an immediate discussion, including people saying that it wasn't all accurate right away.
And then about 3 days later, Stanley and the ACLU issued an update at the bottom of the post, which said that it wasn't based on any firsthand knowledge of China.
We should note that Stanley and the ACLU, they weren't the first ones to get this story wrong, and they certainly weren't the last. I mean, pretty soon after, the type of coverage we heard a little earlier was all over the place. And so many of us in the news media, and we include ourselves at The World and Wired, we didn't get it totally right. And this story and this narrative, it percolated up to the highest levels of government. Even Vice President Mike Pence jumped on board. Here he is speaking at the Hudson Institute, which is a conservative think tank, back in 2018.
By 2020, China's rulers aim to implement an Orwellian system premised on controlling virtually every facet of human life, the so-called social credit score. It will allow the trustworthy to roam everywhere under heaven while making it hard for the discredited to take a single step.
When Jeremy Dahm heard what Pence said and what news outlets were reporting, it kind of outraged him because it was just so wrong. Dahm, by the way, is with Yale Law School's China Center in Beijing.
I've joked before that, you know, saying that you believe that is going to truly imprison the untrustworthy and give great powers to the trustworthy is sort of like seeing McGruff the crime dog say we're going to take a bite out of crime and thinking America is implementing a new biting campaign against criminals.
Dahm has spent a lot of his time over the past few years translating government directives and other legal documents related to the program and trying to debunk the misconceptions that have taken over the Western media narrative.
You know, the main misconception is that it's a rating system for all citizens, that there's some sort of a number that's going up and down like in the nosedive episode of Black Mirror. And that's just not the case. Social credit isn't actually about a rating system for citizens.
Even more outrageous, he says, is the idea that this whole thing is powered by an all-seeing government surveillance system.
I think that one of the things that people get interested in social credit for is that they believe that it's a holistic integration of all of our digital footprint. And it's not that. What social credit is a measure of compliance with regulations, laws, and legal obligations.
Did you catch that? A compliance mechanism. That's basically what this entire system boils down to.
Yeah, and it's meant to address something that Wu Jiechen, a researcher in Taiwan who's been looking at China's social credit system, says happens pretty often on the mainland. So people break the law, and then essentially they dodge the consequences.
It's been years that Chinese courts had this problem that's called 执行难.
She's talking about this non-compliance problem.
So what's the good to get a court judgment if you can't enforce it, right?
So here's what she means. Let's say you lose a lawsuit and the court requires you to pay a fine, but you refuse to pay. In the past, that might have been the end of the story, but now China has this social credit system, and you would end up on a digital rap sheet, what's called a blacklist.
So the government labels you as someone untrustworthy, 失信, and your blacklist status will be shared among government agencies.
There are special punishments that come with being on this blacklist, which is a special list for people who haven't paid their court fines and other debts. you might get banned from taking planes and trains. And there's also this kind of frightening public shaming component. So your picture might be displayed on the news or in social media apps or in other public places.
And Luis, you're talking about a very special blacklist for people who haven't paid their court fines, as you said. But there are also all these other ones aimed at companies and executives in China. And the goal with those blacklists is partly to get them to comply with industry standards and laws. So let's take food safety standards, for example. China has had a lot of scandals in this area in recent years, like the really high-profile one involving baby formula about 10 years ago.
As China's tainted milk scandal spreads across the country, anxious parents are keeping local hospitals busy.
In the past, those company executives might simply start another company, reincorporate under another name, and just keep doing business. But now, the company and the people responsible for the violation would end up on a blacklist, and they could face punishments like, you know, not being able to hold a position at another food company, or they might be denied some industry permits or licenses. And each industry has its own blacklist, its own punishments, and there are more than 40 of these blacklists.
And Lydia, that sharing amongst government agencies that Chen brought up earlier, that's really what's key here, because you're going to face punishments in more than just the food industry. Like, if you get in trouble with the Food and Drug Administration, they might share their blacklist with, say, the Environmental Protection Agency,
who might give you additional punishments. And this is why the slogan of this whole system is
处事性处处受限, meaning that if you're trust-breaking in one area, in one place, you will suffer restrictions everywhere.
Those penalties, though, you only get them if you violate existing laws and regulations. And by the way, for the most part here, we're talking about cases of civil and administrative law, not criminal cases. So in reality, this whole system is just a bunch of spreadsheets that make up this larger database that government officials and the public can search through. So where did all this stuff about a dystopian high-tech scoring system come from?
Well, some of it got lost in translation. The phrase social credit doesn't have the same connotations in Chinese that it does in English. And even if you are fluent in Chinese, it can be really hard to interpret these dense legal documents and what the Chinese government really means.
Right, and part of it is also our perception of China here in the West. The reality is that this is a really, really complicated system. And even though we can't get into all the details, there is one other component we should touch on that's caused a lot of the confusion around the scores. So there are a few cities in China that are piloting so-called good citizen point systems. So if you do a good deed like charity or volunteer work, you might get small perks like a discounted bus fare.
Right. And Xin Dai, who's a professor of law at Ocean University of China, he told us about some of these pilots that are going on in a couple of cities. One of the perks is that if you do certain good deeds like donating blood or volunteering, you get a discount at the library.
The other day I met a journalist who was trying to really try this. You know, basically they went to the library and the library staff didn't really know this, there was this thing.
So not even the library staff knew they were supposed to be offering this perk to people with good scores.
And that's something we heard over and over again, that most people have no idea how these systems actually work or that they even exist. And Xin Dai told us that having this type of scoring program happening on a national level would be pretty much impossible. It would just be too massive of a coordination effort, and it would require the government in Beijing to keep tabs in a way it just hasn't been able to so far.
But just because the system isn't as scary as it's been described in a lot of Western media reports, it doesn't mean that it's not problematic in a lot of other ways. People still have serious concerns about it, including Uja Chen in Taiwan.
The system is imposing layers of disproportionate, arbitrary, and wide-ranging punishments on people who have already suffered consequences of law violations or regulation violations.
For example, just because you didn't pay a court fine, does that mean you shouldn't be able to ride on an airplane? She and other legal scholars are questioning the basis for these kinds of additional restrictions. They're worried about proportionality. Does the punishment really fit the crime? And they're worried about the program's future and the ways that it might evolve, especially given what the Chinese government has already proven it's very capable of doing.
And if you look at Xinjiang, then you really see a a alien state in action.
Xinjiang is a region in northwest China. There, the Chinese government is accused of detaining, surveilling, and persecuting millions of Muslim Uyghurs and other ethnic and religious minorities.
And the government that's doing that, that's the same government working on the social credit system. It's also a government with a track record of human rights violations and a government that historically hasn't been too transparent.
We shouldn't underestimate the efforts that need to be put into in order to develop a social credit system into a complete surveillance scheme. We don't think Chinese government will necessarily be successful in its endeavor, but we know it has been trying.
And that's why Chen and others say they'll be watching closely. For The World, I'm Lydia Manulidu in Boston.
And I'm Louise Matsakis with Wired Magazine in New York.
That story is part of our collaboration with Wired. To read more, go to our website, theworld.org. It's officially been 25 years since Scotty was found. Scotty is the largest Tyrannosaurus rex fossil in the world. Scientists first discovered parts of the fossil in the Canadian province of Saskatchewan back in 1991. Tim Tokarek works at the T-Rex Discovery Center at the Royal Saskatchewan Museum. He was part of the discovery team. He says it took 3 years just to confirm their find. The key moment came when they dug up the dinosaur's jaw with teeth still inside.
After finding it and realizing what it was, I just sort of ran around the hills for about 5 minutes screaming, trying to figure out, okay, how are we going to get this multi-ton animal out of here?
It was an exciting discovery, Tokarek says, but the excavation process was made more complicated by the terrain.
Dinosaurs are often found in a flat level, and this skeleton was not. It wasn't like a 40-foot chicken lying on its side. It was a regurgitated omelet. The bones are all over the place. There was no rhyme or reason which bone was going to which part at that site.
Tim Tokarek says discovering Scotty the T-Rex helped put Saskatchewan on the map for paleontologists.
It really brought Saskatchewan to the fore of paleontology in the sense that Scotty the T-Rex is a marquee animal. There are so much more fossils in the area. I can drive an hour's drive distance around the town and discover 75 million years of history.
As for Scotty, the name of this T-Rex came from a bottle of scotch.
When we decided to name it, that was the only liquor we had left in camp. That's sort of the common cause for why we call it Scotty. So I think there is a bottle of scotch somewhere that may be open for a toast.
Well, cheers to Scotty the T-Rex. The Trump administration wants Guatemala's help with the migrant crisis. When migrants heading north to the U.S. from El Salvador and Honduras cross into Guatemala, they must stop and seek asylum there first. That is the gist of a new agreement Guatemala has signed onto with the U.S. Here's one problem, though. Guatemala does not have a track record of granting asylum. Reporter Emily Green has spent time there. She says the agreement with the U.S. might mean Guatemala will soon be overwhelmed with asylum seekers.
What we're talking about are potentially hundreds of thousands of migrants from El Salvador and Honduras who would no longer qualify for asylum in the U.S.
Right. So they would have to stop in Guatemala, that third country, on their way north. I mean, it's ironic that the White House is calling Guatemala a safe third country when Guatemala's own citizens have been fleeing to the U.S. at a higher rate than residents of any other nation. What kind of numbers are we talking about? And will the Guatemalan authorities actually be able to absorb those numbers of migrants seeking asylum?
Last year, around 57,000 Hondurans and Salvadorans reached the United States, many of them looking for asylum. So big numbers. And Guatemala has four asylum officers in the entire country.
Wow.
Yeah, it's nothing. And right now, it only gets around a couple of hundred asylum claims a year. And even those claims, it hasn't been able to easily process. In fact, it hasn't resolved a single asylum claim all of last year and all of this year so far. So I talked with an official within the Guatemalan government, and he just said to me he has no idea what the administration of President Jimmy Morales was thinking when it signed the agreement, and that he even wonders if to some degree the administration was just sort of assuming that migrants would get to Guatemala, they would see that it was a dead end and turn around.
Emily, you've also been speaking with a number of Guatemalan lawmakers about this deal. What have you heard from them?
On the whole, they're quite critical. They say the country has its own massive problems of poverty and violence. Around 50% of Guatemalans live below the national poverty line. And last year, around 250,000 Guatemalans fled their country and tried to get to the U.S. So I talked to one congressman about the deal. His name is Marcos Yax, and here's what he had to say.
Esto es algo que va a traer consecuencias catastróficas para Guatemala.
He says the deal is going to have catastrophic consequences for Guatemala. He says, if we in Guatemala haven't even been able to deal with our own migratory problems, we're going to have even less success dealing with the migratory problems of other countries.
Apparently, though, this deal also has its supporters in Guatemala, right?
Yes, and it has its ardent supporters. I spoke with Congressman Fernando Linares Beltranena, and here's what he had to say.
I'm sure that the United States will give us the refugee camps, which when the threat of mass caravan ceases, well, the camps will stay in Guatemala. And also it will move the economy, because to build a refugee camp requires a lot of workers, a lot of providers, a lot of food trucks.
Wow. So that Guatemalan lawmaker likes the deal because he sees refugee camps as being good for the economy and will bring in food trucks?
Right. And I'd like to note that he's not the only lawmaker who mentioned the possibility of refugee camps to me. Several did. And the idea is that migrants wouldn't arrive to Guatemala and then be released, where they would then pursue their asylum claim. They would arrive to Guatemala, be apprehended, and put into refugee camps.
I guess one way to view this plan is that the U.S. cannot handle all the asylum seekers and wants to slow things down. Another view is that the U.S. is outsourcing its migrant detention centers to another country. Which view would most Guatemalans say is more accurate?
The deal in Guatemala is deeply unpopular. At the same time, there's a recognition that it was made with a gun to the head, so to speak. President Trump threatened damaging tariffs on Guatemalan products, and perhaps most importantly, he threatened to tax remittances sent by Guatemalans in the U.S. back home. And those remittances, they account for roughly 10% of Guatemala's GDP. Over the weekend, hundreds of protesters gathered before the presidential palace in Guatemala City, and many were holding signs that said, essentially, Morales handed over the sovereignty of our country to the U.S.
Reporter Emily Green in Mexico City, thanks very much for your time, Emily.
Thank you.
Something happened this past weekend that broke the record books of the Tour de France. Egan Bernal became the youngest cyclist, youngest in 110 years anyway, to win the world's most prestigious cycling race. The 22-year-old is from Colombia. That's also unprecedented, and is the first South American to win ever. As you can imagine, all of Colombia, not to mention a lot of Latin America, is celebrating. Reporter Beto Argos is based in Los Angeles, but just happens to be in Colombia at the moment, where he's attending the 47th Annual International Music and Arts Festival in Boyacá. Hey, Beto.
Hey, Marco. Great to be with you. You know, this is a very, very important moment, especially for Colombia right now, because this is not just about the sport. This is about a Colombian who gets to the very top of the world. And, you know, I'm from Mexico, but who cares? I'm a Latin American, and all Latin America is celebrating this amazing win by this young cyclist who just blew people away.
So what have you been able to learn about this 22-year-old Egan Bernal?
You know, he's from a small town. He's from a town about 2 hours away from Bogota, the capital. He's this kind of amazing young kid. There is this incredible culture of cycling that's been, you know, taken over the country for the last decade. So this is something that people already expected to happen. It was a matter of when. It just happened to be yesterday.
So there's this culture of cycling in Colombia. Is there also something about the terrain of Colombia that kind of just breeds strong cyclists?
I actually drove around yesterday in the small towns. In fact, we ran into a couple of cyclists who were behind them. There was a van, of course, because they want to be protected, because, you know, traffic is crazy. They drive in these very small two-lane roads. And also, by the way, this is also very high, so the altitude is very important, too.
Is cycling the new soccer for some Colombians?
This is the second most important sport in Colombia. And Colombia has done pretty well in soccer recently, but nothing like as big as this. You know, they've never been able to win the World Cup. This is the World Cup of cycling. It couldn't come at a better time, Marco. In fact, there's a song that Carlos Vives wrote last year, and he's one of the big rock stars from superstars of Colombia. And it's a song that pays homage to the new generation of cyclists. When one of theirs wins, it's everybody. It's all of Colombia.
Beto Arcos joining us from Boyacá, Colombia. Beto, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Marco.
Thanks for being with us this Monday. The World's theme music was composed by Ned Porter. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.